Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the March 24th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll?
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Novick.
Here.
Hales.
Here. Welcome, everybody. We only have two items on the council calendar this afternoon. They're both a time certain, and the first one is 284.
Accept the report of the Innovation Fund summarizing highlights from projects that were approved for funding in fiscal year 2013-14, fiscal year 2014-15, and fiscal year 2015-16.
You were just here yesterday. You've gotten all this done in 24 hours.
Well, that's a lovely introduction.
Welcome, Jane.
Good afternoon, Mayor, members of council. I'm Jane Brayton with OMF Business Operations Division. And yes, I was going to say we are back again today on innovation, but this time to present you a report on projects that you previously supported earlier in innovation. We wanted to give you just a little bit of background, thanks to some of our contributors, and share some news about our future plans, and then we'll get right to the meat of it, which is hearing more about some of our project leads and the good work they've been doing in your bureaus. So as you know, the Innovation Fund was created in 2013, and then OMF began managing the fund in 2014. We streamlined the application forms, created a process for microgrants, and communicated that council wanted proposals that promoted equity and opportunity, improved customer service, saved time or money for the city, partners, or community members, and improved city services and made things better. We also made a commitment at that time to City Council that we would come back to you with some updates from proposals and share them. And that's really the purpose of today's presentation, is to do some collective learning. What were the lessons learned? What were the successes? How can we share those throughout the city so that we have that culture of innovation in the city and we can really foster that? For background, wanted to share some of the highlights of our statistics. We've had 270 proposals submitted since you supported the creation of this fund. 66 projects were recommended and approved by City Council, including 10 from yesterday. And then new innovative work began in 17 bureaus. We do want to thank our city employees who brought these good ideas forward, because not only have we gained new information, we've gained some new vocabulary in the city. So we have enjoyed as well hearing from our proposals about data scrapers, rubber sidewalks, honeybee bike counters, early adopters, RX play, Moby mats, one call translation services, and there's more and more that we keep hearing about. And as you can tell from the stats, not all of the projects receive a recommendation for funding from our review panel. They do ask tough questions and provide feedback along the way. And some of our project leads have actually taken that feedback and returned with a winning proposal. And you heard that from Elle Weatheroy last week. And some of our projects move forward even without innovation funding, because the innovation process and communication methodology has actually created an avenue for new ideas to surface and get shared with city leadership across bureaus. So we're actually seeing people pick up some ideas and actually get them going, even if they didn't make it in that year, that call for ideas proposal. And speaking of the review panel, we just wanted to take a second and thank them. Our review panel members over the years have given a lot of time in evaluating the proposals and giving feedback. And they are Susan Abbey, Amalia Alarcon-DeMoris, Stephanie Caballero, Warren Chan, Leslie Goodlow, who you'll also meet as a project lead. She did serve on our review panel. Sam Hutchinson, Casey Jama, Benjamin Carratha, Gail Mandel, Amy Nagy, Emily Rice, Tom Simpson, Beverly Stein, Robert Walker, Larry Wallach, and Pamela Weatherspoon. So thank you for letting me acknowledge actually all of the people who served on those panels over the last few years.
It's an interesting mixture of people in and out of city government, yeah.
They brought some tremendous perspectives and given some great feedback to our proposers. We also want to thank City Bureau Directors because they support these innovators, they promote this program within their own organizations, and they also give us feedback on how we can make this process work better. So just a little bit about what's next for the Innovation Fund. With Council's continued support, we have some plans for next year. We'd like to make our innovation website even more robust so there can be better information sharing when news comes back about some of these proposals. Maybe other bureaus want to take advantage of the lessons learned. We also conducted an innovation fair last summer where we brought in people from IT, procurement, HR, and we brought resource people to help our proposers get their proposals ready, help answer some questions so that they would be better received from our review panel. This year we want to do the same thing and actually invite some of our successful proposers, so you'll meet some today, back to share their experience and give that new wave of people some insights, much like an alumni network of innovators within the city. And we also had some plans last year with training. We had Gail Baird from HR's Workforce Development, Training and Workforce Development, and she put on two classes at the same time as our fair in strategic creativity. Those classes were full, and we want to work. We've been working with her this year and putting on a course in process improvement. And we opened up that opportunity first to our people in the city who've put in proposals for the Innovation Fund. So in conclusion, we certainly want to thank the mayor and the council for this Innovation Fund. We think it's a concept that really has made a difference, and we've enjoyed shepherding it to this point. We are proud of the work our city employees have done to bring forward good ideas. Many of our proposers have said, I really didn't have a way to get my idea to happen if it weren't for this fund. And today we have leads from five of our projects here to update you on the status of their projects. Before we do that, I want to introduce Janet Storm. She's from OMF Business Operations. She serves as the primary contact for proposers in our review panel, and she'll be talking about the status report process and the information that we collect from our proposals once they get rolling and get your approval. And then I'll be back up to answer any questions. So, Janet.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Janet Storm. I'm a management analyst with OMF Business Operations, and I coordinate the proposal process. Tracking the status of projects is an important part of the innovation process. Our innovation project leads are required to report their statuses in two ways. One is to report on the decision package to accept the funding, and this requires reporting in the fall and spring bump. The other is to report on the project status to OMF itself. Our deadlines are set just after the fall and spring bump deadlines so that project leads can repurpose the data that they collect for the budget monitoring process. In the project status reports, the leads are asked to share the latest project news, updates to timelines, milestones achieved, results achieved so far, and post-implementation requirements. And we also ask them to list their total expenditures to date, next steps, successes and lessons learned, and feedback on the innovation process itself. In October, we requested status reports on all of the projects that were approved in fiscal year 13-14 and 14-15, and the individual updates are available on the Innovation Fund website at innovate.portlandoregon.gov. The next status reports will be requested in early April on projects that were funded through October 7, 2015. Innovation, by its nature, can be risk-taking, involves risk-taking. However, the rewards can be great, and it can lead to solutions that would otherwise fall by the wayside. And today we are joined by five leads working on a diverse group of projects who will share some updates with you. So first, I'd like to introduce Stephen Ray from the Bureau of Environmental Services, and Stephen will talk about the Multicultural Videos for Food Service Best Management Project. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Steve Ray, and I work in the Extra Strength Sewer Charge Program out of the Water Pollution Control Lab at BES. I'm here today to just give you a brief summary of the multilingual training videos we're doing for food service establishments. As an extra strength sewer charge inspector, I work with the city's fat, soils, and grease inspectors visiting food service establishments to classify the kitchens for rate assessments and also to observe grease trap pump outs. And during the visits, we have to present technical subjects such as sewer rate, best management practice, and grease trap cleaning procedures. And we have to communicate those to kitchen managers and owners to facilitate compliance with the city's rules. The food service industry is very diverse, and communication regarding our program has been a challenge in some cases. BAS staff needed tools for communicating with food service representatives so that compliance with FOG requirements can be achieved even if the representative doesn't speak English. Better restaurant compliance means less enforcement, which is good for restaurants, and it also means less maintenance, fewer backups, and lower costs, maintenance costs, which is a benefit to all city ratepayers. Ensuring that businesses can manage their sewer rates and expenses regardless of language is also essential to promoting equity efforts the city has underway. We applied for the innovation grant to fund the production of these training videos that could be translated into the languages encountered most frequently by the extra strength and fats, oils, and grease inspectors. Working with the BES Communications Division, we prepared scripts for three videos. One is controlling fats, oils, and grease in the kitchen. The other is managing sewer costs. And the third is kitchen best management practices. The audio tracks for the videos will be dubbed in up to seven languages. The number of languages will be limited by the funds that we have after the animation and the video footage has been captured. The hierarchy of languages that we selected to translate into is one Chinese, Spanish, Vietnamese, Thai, Japanese, Korean, and Russian. Each video will be produced to allow preparation of additional language versions easily. So as far as the status of our projects go, we're working on we got the scripts done. An estimate for the translation of the scripts has been obtained by BES Communications, and we're in the process of shortening the script somewhat to lower the cost. They were stretching into quite a few minutes, so we're trying to shorten those up. We provided communications with a list of food service establishments that would be suitable for filming kitchen scenes. Some of these locations we recommended are actually in buildings operated by General Services. Communications has selected a videographer, an animator. He'll do both. And a contract is being finalized with him right now. Our plan is to begin videotaping in April, and to have finished videos available, or at least have the finished videos done by June 30th, 2016. I think there'll be some issues. We'll have to get it onto the website and onto get some tablets to load it into to use in the field. And I guess that leads to when we have all of them done, I'll use the videos when I go to ethnic restaurants where there isn't an English speaker, which happens quite a bit, and I'll be able to communicate the rate information easily without and ensure that everybody's on a level platform as far as who understands the program or not.
So you'll literally take a tablet out to the kitchen of a restaurant, set it up, and show the video?
Yes, Mayor. And that way we can communicate what is very difficult to communicate verbally with some language issues. So it's been a great project to work on. As staff people, we don't get to work with communications division very often, and going through the script development process was very interesting. So thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. Sounds like a great project. Commissioner Fish, since there are 10 safe harbor languages and there's only enough general funding for 7, do you think they might be able to find additional resources so that the other 3 languages could be added while they're currently doing the production? Thank you.
That's great. Other questions? Thanks. That's a great project. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Next up is Leslie Goodloe, who will talk about the Portland Housing Bureau's web data scraper.
Good afternoon, commissioners and mayors. I'm Leslie Goodloe. I'm the business operations manager for the Housing Bureau. And we have been fortunate to have received several innovation fund of our projects funded. The Bureau has greatly appreciated the opportunity to participate in the Mayor's Innovation Fund program. The program has encouraged the Bureau to take risks and leverage modern data gathering and analysis techniques to better understand the housing needs of our community. The Housing Data Web Scraper, or Housing Bot, is used by the Bureau to collect information from the web and transform it into structured data that is stored, analyzed, and trended over time. Using this tool is amazingly fast and efficient compared to browsing through many housing websites such as Airbnb, Zillow, and Redfin, and manually entering the data into spreadsheets. Everyone has been surprised at how easy the data mining tool is to use and how much time we can save through a small piece of innovative technology. A second Innovation Fund project, the XML Data Sharing Pilot Program, converted PHB partner data into a machine-readable language that could be easily downloaded from partner systems and uploaded into PHB systems. This project eliminated hundreds of hours of duplicated data entry and was expanded into phase two, which involved reaching out to faith-based community partners and build relationships to share data on community need. While these projects are primarily focused on data gathering and analysis, they serve the larger purpose of helping the Bureau and Council to better understand the baseline of affordable housing that is currently available and assist in measuring progress as the Bureau works to meet the affordable housing and equity needs of our community. Thank you.
Leslie, I just have one question. Does any of your data mining involve trying to get information from my iPhone? Can you assure us that my iPhone is secure and safe?
That's not our job.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
I have a more serious question. You mentioned using the robot to access Airbnb data. Mm-hmm. Might it be helpful to the Revenue Bureau as they're looking to tighten oversight of Airbnb?
Just let me ask Antoinette, since she's in charge of that. And I know
I wasn't really expecting an answer.
I would imagine that it would.
And maybe you could offer that. So since we funded the software, it looks like she's nodding back there.
Yes, Antoinette says absolutely.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you, Leslie. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Our next project lead is Michelle Kunick-North from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And Michelle is going to talk about the Making Great Decisions tool.
Good afternoon, Council. Thank you for having me. As Janet mentioned, I'm Michelle Kunick-North with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I'm here to provide a quick update on the Making Great Decisions tool. This project is really about making better planning decisions. As you all know, the Portland Plan, the Comprehensive Plan Update, the Joint Climate Action Plan all set these broad goals: equity, economic prosperity, human and environmental health, resiliency, to shape the framework of what the city's trying to provide. But how do we as planners make day-to-day decisions that are going to advance those broad goals? That's really what this project is trying to support. So after receiving the Innovation Micro Grant, we set off to think first about how do we even have this conversation internally and how do we do that in a more innovative way rather than, you know, convening a weekly meeting for a few months. And we settled on something called user-centered design. It's more common in product design, web design. And the idea there is to go and talk to the end users. Don't build a better vacuum if what people want is a broom. And so we started by talking with planners, project managers, and leadership across the Bureau to find out what the need really is. What are the desired outcomes? What kind of staff support is necessary? And what sort of challenges should we expect along the way? And we really started to hear that staff want to be advancing these broad goals, but they need some assistance in understanding how general planning work ties to those larger goals and how we might make better decisions throughout a planning process to either maximize co-benefits or reduce negative impacts. The second thing that we heard loud and clear was to use a lot of the city's existing resources, our GIS data, the equity toolkit, the public involvement principles, all of these things that we can derive ideas from and kind of synthesize something that works better for staff. The other piece about user-centered design that I wanted to mention today is it really focuses on rapid iterations or prototyping of ideas. And I think this is really in keeping with the innovation theme. The idea is that multiple approaches are expected. They're encouraged. It's okay to fail. It's okay if something doesn't work right out of the chute. And that really helped us not get stuck in a preconceived notion of what the solution might be. And we ended up deciding that we actually need three different types of solutions, a piece or a module that works with staff when they're scoping a project, so they can think about those, the initial project design, a piece that looks at concepts or alternative analysis, and then a piece that's really about those final findings or justification for a project. So this is definitely still a work in progress. We're refining the tool and filling in pieces, but I'm hopeful that it can support decision making in the future.
I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to steal your best line about don't build a better vacuum if the user needs a broom. And where that impacts me regularly is when I get automatic upgrades to my software at work and at home. And what I find is that periodically someone has offered me this plethora of new functionality that I can't figure out and don't need, whereas I really just need to do my email and occasionally do a Word document. And I think that's one of the challenges of technology. It keeps advancing and offering all these upgrades and new bells and whistles, but it sort of sometimes overwhelms the user. And I don't ever remember getting an email from Microsoft saying, you know, what would you know? what's good for you?
Yeah.
So I love that. I love that statement, and I love the idea of user-centered design. I think it is a good reminder for all of us and across the board in what we do, that we think about the end user, not just about the advance of technology. So,
yeah, I think the Planning Bureau's map app was a great example of that, where we really thought about how do we get citizens to access the planning process. And so using technology with that purpose rather than letting it kind of run amok. Yeah, good point. Other questions for Michelle? Thanks very much.
Great
work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to ask Eileen Argentina of Parks to come up and talk about the Peninsula Park Rose Garden Project.
Good afternoon. Oh, you got slides? Okay.
You have slides.
There we go.
Thank you, Jane and Janet, and good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Eileen Argentina from Portland Parks and Recreation. I'm joined today by Pat Frobes, one of the founders of the Friends of Peninsula Park Rose Garden. Pat also happens to be on our Parks Board. We are delighted to have this opportunity to showcase how innovation funds contributed to our collaborative partnership and benefited Portlanders. The vehicle for this improvement has been the development of what we now call a preservation strategy for the Peninsula Park Rose Garden. The microgrant provided funds for us to conduct a community survey as part of the project. And first, I want to acknowledge the journey which led us to this piece of work, which we want to share with the council today. And we use the term work loosely because it's really been a joy and a partnership. We've been mutually inspired with our partners to invest in a collaboration to produce results both in the garden and behind the scenes to ensure the preservation of the city's first rose garden. I'm going to be skipping through a few slides here, so don't be put off if it looks like you're missing some.
Okay.
Sorry, this was done for another audience, and we want to make the best use of your time today.
As Eileen said, I'm Pat Frobes, one of the three co-founders of the Friends of Peninsula Park Rose Garden. We were created in 2012 by two other OSU Master Gardeners, and we immediately partnered with Parks, and I would say that the Parks Bureau has been a fabulous partner. We could not have accomplished what we have in 3 years without them. In the 3 years, we've replaced over 6,000 roses with new disease-resistant varieties, all of which have been donated. We started in 2012 with 10 to 15 volunteers, about half of whom were regulars. Last year, we had 129, over 60 of whom were regular volunteers, came regularly. As we'll show in some charts later on, 2010, there were 500 volunteer hours, and in 2015, there were 2,000. We've also planted 15,000 crocus as a part of Parkadium and sponsored and supported a number of community events in the garden. What we really want to do now, and starting last year, started to focus on, is creating something sustainable that will sustain city and citizen investment in this garden for the next 100 years. The garden is 103, and we want to preserve it for the next 100 years. As a part of that effort, we decided we needed to create some kind of strategic plan that would serve as a roadmap for that investment and would not, the implementation of which would not be dependent on any particular group or any particular individual, but could have some kind of life of its own, if it's well, as groups, people come and go, could connect to this plan and continue to make it happen. In order to do that, we needed to better understand the priorities and characteristics of some of our key stakeholders, including, most importantly, our visitors and neighbors. With the microgrant, we were lucky enough to be able to hire two wonderful interns, Kira Leslie from Portland State and Luz Maria Vega, a graduate of Rosemary Anderson High School, who has been accepted in the Portland Teachers Program, neighborhood resident, bilingual, and could and did conduct the survey in both Spanish and English. They spent 82 hours surveying 357 respondents over 6 weeks, different times, different days of the week, different times of the day. And we found, and we got a lot of wonderful information. I think that would be the next slide. And we'll go through this quickly. We found that over 94% of our residents come from the east side, of, east of the Willamette River. One of, as you'll see, this will tie to one of our objectives. We need to raise the profile and introduce the rest of the city to this.
94%.
94% wow. East of the river. That's yeah. Wild. 66% from the zip codes covering St. John's, Overlook, Arbor Lodge, Canton, Piedmont, Humboldt, Woodlawn, and King neighborhoods. So we have a lot of, we have work to do to get the word out about this truly hidden gem. It's a very diverse group of visitors. 30% are people of color, and the ethnic makeup of the visitors is quite close to the ethnic makeup of the half-mile service area around from Peninsula Community Center. All full range of incomes, half under making under $50,000 a year, half making over $50,000 a year. Most people found out about the garden because they lived in the neighborhood, and this ties to another more limited survey we did at National Night Out, where we interviewed about 30 neighbors. But because we have so much overlap between the visitors and people who live in the neighborhood, I think the views reflected here are give us a lot of clues about what the neighbors think as well. Everybody agrees. It's kind of self-evident. It's about the roses. That's what people come for. That's what they enjoy. This is just a word cloud that shows how often by size of letters those words were mentioned in the survey. That's a, just a bar chart of the same results. People come to smell the roses, relieve stress, socialize, certainly echoes of the 2020 vision about public places that connect people to self and others, which you'll see reflected in some of the objectives. One of the things we didn't know is how many people just come to Peninsula Park and then, oh, by the way, there's a rose garden. Well, we found half of them come for the garden alone and about half come for both the garden and the park. And over half of the guests visit at least once a week, sometimes more than once a day. When we ask folks what they would most like to see make their visit more enjoyable, they'd like more places to sit, some relief from the sun, and closer bathrooms. Unfortunately, some of these are incompatible with roses, like shade, and others like benches are probably not compatible with a historical design, but we have tried to take other priorities into account as we develop the plan. This is just a, you know, some of the wonderful quotes we of people we talked to. One of the things we found is that there are a significant number of the visitors are people who either were longtime residents of Piedmont and or some of the other neighborhoods, or who grew up there, who have moved and come back to celebrate family events, to share the garden and their experiences with their own kids. And this group of, we call historic neighbors, we want to reach out to as we move forward with the implementation of the plan.
We heard a lot of really wonderful stories in the conversations that the outreach workers had about the role that this park has played in family history and family traditions. It was really wonderful. It's just an overview of the garden. And this slide, actually the next one, pretty vividly illustrates the impact that the Friends have had on the park over the last several years. The group didn't even exist until 3 years ago, and you can see the growth in volunteer hours. And this is one of the reasons it was so important for us as a Parks Bureau to really step up and support the work that this group is doing and really leverage it. And I think this strategy has been a great product of that.
If you could just go back to that slide, I want to just make the point, though, that it's not that the volunteers are taking the place of staff or doing union jobs. It's that we haven't had as many staff to do it, and the volunteers have picked up some of the slack. And so I really want to appreciate that as the regular staff have been cut. I think this, you'd probably say that we could use more of both.
You'd see, we would like more of both, yes.
Thank right. you.
That is so true. I think the recognition of the role each group has to play has become really strong, and I think that shows up in the strategic objectives. Thank you, Commissioner. Well, the preservation strategy itself resulted in a vision, a mission statement, and then four major strategic objectives. And as it's written here, the vision is a world-class public garden of great beauty and rich historical legacy that generations of Portland residents and visitors seek out for quiet reflection, social connection, education, and celebration. We really wanted to respect the role this park has played in the neighborhood and for people who live there today and generations who've been there in the past. The vision is consistent with what visitors told us and what volunteers and park staff said was, their ideal picture of the garden in 5 years, thriving roses in a garden full of a diverse group of people of all ages, sharing the experiences and memories that build community. And it's worth noting that the survey results caused us to reconsider how we frame this project. Visitors were initially put off by the notion of a strategic plan. They thought it was going to create something new and different at the park, when their priority was to preserve and enhance the park as designed. As a result, the effort was renamed the Peninsula Park Rose Garden Preservation Strategy. It was one of those small but significant changes that did a much better job of capturing the values of all concerned, and I really believe it wouldn't have happened without the grant supporting our outreach. I'm going to turn it back to Pat now for four slides on the objectives.
Mm-hmm. And that probably...
Oh.
Yeah. Yes, we want more of both. We want... our first objective is to maintain the stunning roses. That's what people come for. We'd like to increase the amount of horticultural staff time devoted to the garden. We want to increase the volunteer time as well. We want to mulch the garden to keep the roses healthy, and we'd like to eventually be able to replace and expand the irrigation system. The hardscape, most of the original elements of the garden are still there, the original brick pavers, balustrades, etc. They really are now kind of in disrepair. They need to be fixed or they're not going to last. We have Parks has funded an initial assessment of the hardscape. We think we have a phased plan to do those repairs. We've gone through the capital improvement process and hope to be able to start that with some volunteer help, just scraping moss and the like in 2017. We want to promote the town square, the role it's played in the neighborhood, and we want to raise the profile. And to that end, we are going to do three neighborhood events annually starting in 2017. We're already doing an ice cream social and supporting Sunday Parkways and the Portland Symphony Festival. We also are going to do two citywide events annually, one of which we've started, Art in the Rose Garden, which we'll do again in August. And we will work to install certain garden amenities like bike racks and improve signage. We hope to be able to fund that this year. Overall, we've got to finance the vision. We'll spend a lot of this year doing a comprehensive plan for raising accessing private funds for both garden maintenance and funding a portion of the hardscape repair, and then developing a plan to access private funds to fund a portion of completing the original MSHA plan, which involves constructing a pergola on Ainsworth.
We just have a few more slides, just visuals for you. It's been a wonderful journey, and we really feel like the partnership is set up for success with this, especially with this additional community input. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share our story.
A couple of questions. You've had some great donations in recent years, like the Neil Kelly Company, for among others. The preservation strategy includes a philanthropic portion, I assume?
Yes, that will be part of our financing division,
And the other just notion that occurs to me that I'm not sure if there's a public art opportunity or something there, but there's an unsung hero of the park system who I think is only mentioned in one plaque in the city, and that's Emmanuel Miche. Right. Someday we ought to figure out a way to name something for this guy or otherwise give him a little more recognition, because this iconic space, along with Laurelhurst Park and Mount Tabor and Selwood Park, a lot of the other parks of the city that everybody treasures, were designed by him. And, he's the first corporate refugee, got moved to Portland by the Olmsted Company and then refused to go back to New York and got a job here as the first park superintendent. So someday we ought to figure out a way to give that a little more visibility at this park and some of the others that he designed.
Well, if we're lucky enough to be able to build out his original design and build the pergola on Ainsworth, where you could have an arbor, et cetera, it's perfect.
That would be perfect. Okay, that's a good idea. Other questions? Thank you both very much.
Our final presenter today is Jody Yates from the Portland Bureau of Transportation, and Jody will talk about the rubber sidewalk project. Pilot.
Okay. Carlos is going to cue it up for you.
Yeah.
Speaking of technology that no one understands.
I just don't want to screw up.
There you go.
Thank you. My name is Jody Yates. I'm with the Bureau of Transportation. I'm one of the managers over in Maintenance Operations Group. One of the programs that I administer is the Sidewalk Repair Program. And this is a program that identifies sidewalk that requires repair, and we follow up with property owners to make sure that that repair occurs. We estimate that, let's go down the page. About 80 to 90% of the sidewalks that are posted for repair are caused by tree roots. And it's basically mature tree roots are pushing up on the rigid concrete sidewalk. We kind of know this. We have some properties that we post basically every 5 to 7 years for the same problem. And then the average repair cost is $1,200 per property. So the goal is to explore materials that could alleviate that ongoing cost to the property owners and to make a safe, accessible environment for our pedestrians. Here's an example you can see in the photo of repair that has occurred and already is ready for repair again. That's about an inch and a half lift on the right-hand side of that photo, which could cause a pretty significant trip hazard to a pedestrian. Let's see. So what is rubberized sidewalk? It is a flexible, porous pavement product. It's basically recycled rubber, and they use tires and a patented binder. Versus concrete, which is made of gravel, sand, cement, and water, and it's very rigid. Here was our pilot project. On the left-hand photo is the rubberized sidewalk, and we had three patches of that done around three trees, and on the right-hand side is rigid concrete sidewalk. And we put these in the same place on city-owned or city-maintained sidewalk, so it is one of the locations that gets repair approximately every 5 years. So it's our responsibility to maintain, and we put 3 with rubberized sidewalks for the trees and 3 with concrete, so we'll have a direct comparison to monitor. And if you get the close-up view, you can see the difference. The left-hand side is that rubber sidewalk. And when you walk on it, it's like walking on a rubber track, kind of like the track around Dunaway Park, that kind of material, which I think is actually a different material, but it feels very similar. And then, obviously, concrete sidewalk on the right. Some of the things that you lose with the rubberized sidewalk are the functionality of having the aesthetics of having the broom marks and the aesthetics associated with all the cut marks and things like that. So there is something to be seen there.
I wonder whether the broom marks were considered aesthetically pleasing. I thought that was just how it turned out.
No, those are actually put in with a broom.
To know.
Yeah. And they actually provide for a little bit of friction for you to walk on.
Right, I thought that was functionality rather than the aesthetics.
I think, yes, it's both,
so
I think.
So your rubberized does the same thing.
You're a concrete finisher, you think it's both.
I think, yes, I think the concrete finishers would say it's both.
They take great pride in those broom marks.
I will cherish them.
So we did the installation last July, and the grant we received was $6,000. Our cost to install was around $14,000. Part of that was we trained all of our concrete finishers, sent them through some video, and then they all got to participate with the finishing of the product. So if we move forward with this, doing any other applications, they're all adequately trained. We did our first inspection in January, and one success is there is no postable trip hazard, but that's in both groups. One thing that was noted, and these are more subjective, might be a little bit more on the slippery side, and so I get to pretend I'm an engineer and use words like coefficient of friction, so we wanted to evaluate that a little further. And then we have concerns with how other users, those on the 2- and 4-wheeled varieties, might, how they would experience this. So we're going to do some more evaluation on that.
On that point,
yes, sir.
What's the basis for the concerns? Have you seen any problems or?
One of the persons we had inspect has some mobility issues himself, and he noted that it was a little bit. He felt like he was wanting to slip on it, but it was in the wet, and so it's just something we want to look at and see what we can do to alleviate that concern. This is also on a pretty good slope; it's in the 5% to 8% range. So we're going to. What's our next steps? We're going to continue evaluate. Unfortunately, in the world of engineering and civil engineering type products, sometimes that can be a longer time to find out if we get to quote success. In this area, it was a 5 to 7 year of reposting. So it might take us a few years, but we're going to continue to monitor every 6 months. Go out and check out the sidewalk. From the engineering standpoint, if we did find success and it was a product that we can put into that our citizens can use, we would modify the standard drawings and our specifications and add it to the CPL list. But ultimately, the goal would be is that we would save time, money, and have a safe pedestrian environment. That would be the ultimate success. We will continue to explore other products and put those out in the city as well to evaluate.
Questions?
I just wanted to say that I really appreciate this experiment. Obviously, it is a big imposition. We tell people to fix their sidewalks, and if there's a way that we can have people do that more seldom and save some trees to boot, that would be great. So I think it's worth a lengthy and careful experiment, and thank you very much for bringing it forward.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Jody.
Thanks, everybody, for sharing your updates, and Jane and I would now like to answer any questions you might have.
I have a couple. It's very clear from this report that 2 of the goals have been met: to improve customer service to the community and or city customers, and to improve city services and make things better. And the report has anecdotal evidence that that is the case. The 2 that I'm not seeing any data on are promote equity and opportunity in city governments and the community, and saving time or money for city partners or community members. So I don't need an answer now, but before the end of the calendar year, I'd like a follow-up report on how much time or money have we saved, and what are the demographics of people who have been reached and assisted by these grants?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's great. Other suggestions or guidance? That will be helpful, I think. We're trying to measure what we're getting for this, and that would be really an important thing to see. So thank you. Great work. Thank you very much. Anyone want to comment on this report other than those who already have? If not, then...
Move to accept the report.
Second.
Take a roll call vote to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. So I would appreciate a follow-up within 6 months or so with that information, because I appreciate the amount of interest that we've had from city employees and the willingness to do things differently, to do things better. I want to make sure that we are meeting all of the goals that the project set out to do, and I very much appreciate your diligence on that. Aye.
Thank you for outstanding presentation. I'm guessing, by the way, that the BES presentation on the fats, oil, grease program and the videos in different languages, which was specifically targeted to Mid and East County, where we were increasingly finding ethnic restaurants where there were language barriers. This does meet very directly that equity component, but I'm sure there are others. And it's been fun to hear all the thoughtful and creative ideas and then to see them moving forward and get feedback on what we're learning. And we actually are the only area of society where we're not allowed to fail in aid of getting a better product. So for those of you who read Steve Jobs' book, which is a 500-page tome to failure, and he finally got it right, we actually are in a sector where failure is not tolerated. But the truth is experimentation and innovation and all these things require you to take chances and risks. And then sometimes we get it right, sometimes we don't, but then we fine-tune it and we keep moving forward. And that's the spirit of what we're doing. And I think these were a terrific group of projects you highlighted for us today. So thank you. Aye.
Yes, these were great projects, and I appreciate the spirit of innovation. And I thank the Office of Management and Finance for providing the evaluation and the opportunity to share these exciting innovations, and thank the mayor for spiriting the Innovation Fund. Aye.
Novick.
This is it's always really inspiring to hear about the old projects and the new projects, and I second what Commissioner Saltzman just said. I think that the Innovation Fund is going to be a major part of the legacy of both Mayor Hales and Fred Miller, and I really appreciate their leadership in this. Aye.
Hales.
Well, this is great work. Thank you. I think I may have had a chance to relate to at least one or two of my colleagues. One of my favorite conversations about city management, which was when I went to my first U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting back in January of 2013. You know, I'd just gotten elected. I just sworn in. I'm getting to work and trying to decide, like we all do, how much time should I spend on extracurricular stuff versus always keeping my nose to the grindstone here in the city. And I was actually walking down the hall at this first meeting with Greg Fisher, who's the mayor of Louisville. And he, if not completely complying with Mike Bloomberg's advice to make your first billion before you run for mayor, Greg had at least been successful. He is a very successful business person who then decided to give back to his city by running for mayor. And I'm walking down the hall with him, and I'm saying, well, I'm trying to decide, you know, how much time to spend on this. You've been mayor for a couple of years in Louisville. You know, what's your advice? And he has this very, you know, straight-ahead sort of CEO style. And he said, well, how many people do you have working for the city? I said, well, about 5,600. Why? He said, well, how many of them are charged with big-picture thinking and research and development? And I said, well, actually, not very many. I see your point. Okay, I'll show up and learn something. But that, you know, that spirit of, you know, all of us should be spending at least some of our time and effort on big-picture thinking and research and development, and that's part of the impetus behind this. And there are a lot of creative people, as we've seen, with what was the total again? How many hundreds of proposals? 270 proposals. And only 20% or so of them have actually been able to be funded. But we've got a real fountain of really good ideas started with our own smart people. And so it's really fun for me, and I think fun for the council to see the results. Important to measure them, as Commissioner Fritz once again reiterated here. But this is a good idea, and I appreciate the big picture thinking in the R&D. Aye. Thank you very much. Okay.